Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Japan's greatest victory, Britain's worst defeat, the capture of Singapore in 42, and it's by a Colonel Tsuji, who is really deeply in command, or a deep intelligence person with the Japanese army going forward. And this is the third episode, sort of embedded in, I think, up to the 38th episode of me reading, podcasting. This is, I'm doing cardiac rehab, getting to read a bit more. This third episode is of this little pamphlet, Read This and the War Will Be Won, an episode, a little pamphlet which has been given to all Japanese soldiers and all the boats as they travel to Malaysia. And now, embedded in this is intensely interesting information, because the information and some of the assumptions and the myth that the Japanese had in their heads as they're invading and fighting their way through and demolishing all the Australian forces up in Malaya. And they demolished, there was a big fight, but yeah, they won at the end of it all. And so, it's sort of intensely interesting on several levels. So here, as a commentator, I'm not, although I'm a member of the RSL, I'm not an official war historian or anything like that. And so, best I can do is actually read the documents, and I've got no personal authority, but I can say, sort of say, well, this is an authentic document from the person who actually masterminded the invasions. These were his thoughts as he put them down. Some of them are fanciful, some of them are not necessarily correct, but some of them would require verification. He said very clearly that they invaded Thailand in Thai uniforms, waving a white flag. He says very clearly about Japanese war atrocities and the fact that he wasn't fully content with the 30 days house arrest, which means half pay and not fighting, for rape. So he says this. Now, people are very caught up. Is this true or not true or something like that? It's not necessarily true or not true. It's just the fact that this commander has said this. Now, the other aspect is that this is a pamphlet full of information. It's a combination of war tactics, which is very good, setting out the basic war tactics, which if they had, it would be very worthwhile to read, but also it's a links back to Japanese legends. And you realise that the Japanese legends, as you try and chase them up and work out, is this true? Like, you'll be in a conversation with a kid or something like that. And I said, oh, did you know that according to this person, Thailand was occupied by Japan at a particular point in time? For the set of reasons this person believed it. And I'd say, oh, no, it's not. And then you go through and that's one aspect of it. There's the statements which clearly are sort of a little bit tangential to reality. But then there's also these other things about where there's references to the emperor worship, restoration, all that sort of understanding of Japanese history, but also references to the feats of samurais and what could be done. So the actual samurai culture is still very much alive in there. This is sort of parallel to the study of Germany. Again, many years afterwards, it's really academic fireside chats to say, oh, look, Wagner was a friend of Hitler. Wagner wrote these operas which actually transformed the German warrior legend into a modern militaristic fascist legend. The Wagnerian opera. And they wore opera uniforms and to use the same people to stage manage. There's a crossover between, in Germany, a crossover between the culture and the film and stuff like that. So the, and it's like a really complex crossover. So, I was trying to think, who is it, Oberth? I can't really remember there's a German rocket scientist who has began his career building a film about rockets, a German film about rockets. And that led to a lot of the modern concepts of rockets, this German Nazi war film about rockets came across. So you've got that, and a lot of the links in there between science, technology, culture, history, all came together, all stuck together with these legends. And in the German legend, it's the Wagnerian legends, the Ring of the Nibelung, the story of the Rheingold and Siegfried and all and his Brunhilde, funeral pyres, Valkyries, and all this type of stuff. The myth of the noble fight. Now it seems to me that this sort of there's a sort of certain susceptibility to these myths. Now there's the myth of the jihad. Now going across. Now what's different here? You can sort of say, oh well, the evidence is that they dressed up in Wagnerian uniforms. The evidence is that they went through a series of processes which were very much mapped to the Wagnerian opera. You can do those observations, but at the end of the day, that's just a fireside chat, you know. Yeah, that there's some people say, oh, that's a fascinating thing, there's not much I can do with it, but that's, thanks a lot for that, that's very interesting. Here is slightly different. I'm actually reading the actual words of the Japanese colonel, intelligence colonel, staff officer. This is basically a operative which seems to operate between ranks and between units. He was a liaison officer, the eyes and ears, and an important person. And it is referenced because his ideas were written down and actually given to the Japanese soldiers. Now, you can then therefore say it's not rather than it's airy fairy out in the culture. Did the Japanese soldiers actually read this pamphlet, believe this pamphlet, and do the actions? Well, the answer is perhaps yes, because a lot of what's written in this pamphlet foreshadows the style and behaviour, like it's like a pre-programming aspects. And you could say, no, I disagree with you, that's not true. Japanese people could read these pamphlets, be involved in the culture, behave this way, but that's not evidence. You can't actually, unless you get inside their brain and interview them before and after and do a series of tests, it doesn't meet the standard of proof, say, that we would do for, say, if we had someone in society today, a police arrest someone for doing a trial. The actual, so really the standard of proof, we're not going to be able to go down to it, but it is very interesting to look at it. And it's interesting how these legends, which we would say are legends, and have to be held with a certain reality checks with it, don't have those reality checks, that they're actually, you know, a force of things. And so in Australia that could be the landing of the First Fleet and the squatter and the larrikin. Well, we've got these aspects in the Australian legends which we don't question, but when you look into it, the reality is very, very different. Human weakness and stuff like that. So look, there's two aspects I want to do before I get into reading this next section, which is to do with the battle, which is sort of like a blood-curdling read. If I've ever read it, it sort of makes you absolutely terrified if you read that. Well, the first one is, if you read into the book, he says, in Thailand, the Japanese were originally in Thailand, okay, and they made a visit to a particular temple and saw so-and-so's name still written there from 300 years earlier. And you say, okay, so this is an area of history. I didn't quite fully understand the different peoples of Indochina. There's things you used to do. Perhaps Japan actually did own Thailand. And because this is what this Japanese general said, and this Colonel Tsuchi says, and the actual people have got these relationships and concept of Thailand which doesn't go there. And now if you actually look at it, the Thais declare war on Australia. They, within, you know, a couple a day or 5 days that they go from being a neutral place to someone who declares war on the Allies with, and allies themselves with Japan. And so you say, well, perhaps this may be it. Perhaps we didn't know this about the Thai people. And so this is Yamato. That's an incorrect pronunciation. Being sort of memory coming back, I remember M-A-M-A-T-O. I deliberately, when I do these podcasts, I don't have notes because that defeats the purpose of them. I'm sorry if it makes it frustrating for you. So this Japanese dude, was he a ruler in Japan? What exactly happened? So what did happen? These are the facts, courtesy of Wikipedia and other sources, so they're internet facts. As much as the facts are any facts, that's like the facts of this person coming across. So the Japanese invade Thailand, motor across to Bangkok, overthrow Bangkok, and within a very short time, these troops, who could have been defeated easily, I believe, these good-looking guard troops, sort of the nicest, how could you object to such good-looking Japanese soldiers? Who were really quite nice and had this complicated feeling with Thailand. It's sort of like, oh, it's so complex. They go across and visit this temple of the old Thai ruler. Now, in actual fact, what actually happened is that Japan was producing a hell of a lot of samurai, right? And Japan had expatriate populations of persecuted populations. They had the Jesuits came into Japan, converted a few Japanese to Christianity. These Japanese didn't fit in. They were put in exile and they formed an exile expat population in, Japan. And, they formed a trading relationship. So there was such a thing called, of Japan, the trading relationship was very closed, and trade only could go into Japan through something called Red Seal ships. So the central government would issue a Red Seal, and that would allow you, so it's somewhat as in a Red Seal, as in seal, I think this is a seal with a red stamp on it or something like that. And these special ships would go around and allowed you to trade, do official trade, so it's sort of like a monopoly associated with it, and you can see start to unplug to why the isolation. It was just more that the political system allowed monopolies, and so if you could isolate it, people, you could actually milk them for money, as far as I could see. So they formed this expat population of samurais. Now the samurai people were great warriors, and helped the king of Thailand, of Siam, repel an attack from Burma. And so this person with a small village of Japanese people had good trading relationships with the Thais, and could take silver and craftwork from Japan and sell it to the Thais, and in return they could get deer hide for some reason and give that back to Japan, some sort of trade relationships. And so he was a commander. So these Burmese people suddenly deal with these samurai shock troops, not many of them, just 300 or something like that. And so this person rose high up in the Thai court until he didn't. So he rose up for a few years and then did the wrong thing and got ousted. But in the meantime, he was a pirate raiding the Dutch fleets, and the Dutch fleets chased him, but when they realised that he was such a Japanese person and linked to the King of Siam and wanted to keep Thailand on side, they decided not to persecute him. And so he had all this booty, and it's mythologically incomplete spoof. I think there's a belief that he went down the Great Barrier Reef and actually on one of the islands off the Barrier Reef, buried treasure. So it's Japanese pirate treasure is somewhere around, but there is missing treasure out there as well. And so he did all these things. Now, this reality infiltrated into Japan was that there was a great Japanese ruler in Thailand who owned all of Thailand. He was a vassal. There, remember these are, even though we call it the 17th century or 17th century, a lot of the place was still feudal. Process like that. So it rose up a Japanese expat community, which was there for a reason, but also had this trade. And so this sort of figment has actually gone down and it's been nurtured to be of Japan's going up. And you can see that Japan is getting rather hurt by not trading properly. And there's a feeling that the Shogun era left Southeast Asia to itself, with the nasty Europeans in. If you read the story, that's the general narrative. Less than a million Europeans control 200 million people in India right through Asia, and they're just milking them and laughing at the natives. But the natives themselves are idle, idle, unclean, and just sit around having heaps and heaps of children. Disgusting, as I said, and various things don't go into native villages, or you get bed bugs, and all the natives have venereal diseases, and all this type of stuff, which, look, by the standards of the time, wasn't all that bad, because I was up in the Baillieu Library. I would read, this is London from 1932, tourist guides of London, and they would talk about the Jewish district of London and the Jew, and this is sort of like modern day tourist brochures, but sort of set back there, with classic things, the people serving you with a smile and the little piece of lace on their head and all that type of stuff, and good, but it's absolutely frothing. The whole world was frothing with racism and mad ideas at this time. So really, this should be read in the context of some of the stuff the English brought up. Just sort of insane. The whole world was insane back then. But getting back in here, in this book, is they reference the the 47 samurai, or leaderless samurais, NONAI. Look, I can't really remember. Again, this is cardiac rehab, so I read a word, I can't really remember the writing of it. The 47 samurai, so remember the honour of the 47 samurai. So this is a story worthwhile going back, and I won't get a chance to read this pamphlet, so it may as well stop. So in the pamphlet 35, you've got to remember the 47 samurai. Why? What? I haven't heard of 47 samurai. 47 sounds a really unusual number. Sort of a dozen, three dozen, or 300. 300 Spartans, 47 samurai, what's going on here? So, the story goes like this, and it's worthwhile listening to, because there's a lot of things. There's a samurai leader, and the samurais must have their leader. If they don't have their leader, they must all basically be unemployed, be destitute, or kill themselves. So, therefore, they have to look after their leader, or they all die. Now, this leader, it's some sort of Japanese temple, of the 47 samurais, 47, there are 47 key samurais, but then there's hundreds beneath that. And so what happens is this leader does the wrong thing. He has insult, he draws his sword against a higher up leader, and for doing that, for honour, he has to kill himself. That, harikuri or whatever it is. And so, he does. He says, "Oh, damn it! Sorry, mate. Oh, right. I better go off and kill myself now." He goes off and kills himself. And of course, this is a major problem. He's disgraced himself, leader, and he has now all these unemployed samurai are going around the place. Now, these unemployed samurai, watch out, there's a bit of a trick to it. They make a plan to avenge the master's death, as you do. And there's a cunning plan. What they're going to do is look completely distraught, completely lost, and stuff like that. And they go around the place being complete losers and drunkards and stuff like that, and going to the geisha houses with the prostitutes, and the spies go, it's sort of standard thing to get revenge in Japan at this stage, you know, so this simple person drawing a sword leads to suicide, leads to massive war, you know, as it happens. And so the leader makes a pact with these people, and they start to plan, to trick, to fade, make false things, and they come in as tradesmen into this person's house, and they fix up to get the designs of the house, and that, you know, bakers and stuff like these samurais. You can imagine a baker. What happened to the last baker? He was a pretty weedy, sort of uncoordinated person, but you're really buff for a baker. Oh, you're hammering my toilet door together. Thanks a lot. Oh, you're rather strong. Oh, okay. Not thinking nothing of it. In the meantime, the spies are looking, and they're looking at the chief one, and he's a complete, total wreck. But no, it's just a show. And they come over, and on the preordained night, which is on a date, which is also really interesting. Everything must be done on a date. Similar to Singapore, it has to fall on a date. This also happens on a particular date. They go out there, and they go to the house, they quell the neighbours, kill the guards, put arches on the top of the roof, so it must have been a fairly big place, because say if it was in my house, it only fit, well, I don't know, at most. Yeah, a few arches up there. It must have been a big pad. And arches on the roof to do people, and the samurai went through, and they went through the place fighting other samurai and killing them off, and then they go pull down a sheet and see a secret courtyard. In the secret courtyard there's a secret coal place. Well, this is interesting, there's coal in Japan, but they pull people out, and they can't find it out. And eventually, they recognise the Lord. He's the person at he's got a cup on his head from when he fought with the other samurai a long time ago. Whatever it is, there's a cut there. You've got the cut, samurai. This must be you. Okay, all right. Well, here he is. It's really bad for a samurai to kill someone so high up. Will you commit suicide? Here's the sword. You just commit suicide. And he's blabbering. He's just lost it. He doesn't want to commit suicide. And so they go, oh, what the heck? And they just kill him. And then they say, oh, how does the story end? Oh, well, these 47, one person escapes, and these 47 samurai, some as young as 16. So there's something, some story going on there, because how can you be a 16-year-old samurai after a year? You'd be 15. It sort of doesn't quite add up. But here am I, just look. I'm just relating. I'm not trying to explain it. I said, oh, well, now you know what you've done. You've broken the samurai code. Okay, right, sorry, but we have avenged our leader's death, so now honour has been restored to our clan, so the samurais, the other few hundred samurai who were with the clan could now get work. So once you were tainted, you've put the mark against your mark, you saw the mark, your card, here's my samurai working card. Is that dishonour, and I've had that removed, like a credit check or something like that? That's removed. And so the 47 people, in honour, all committed suicide, and their graves are honoured today, and there's museums with their original homemade armour, because they couldn't buy armour, because that would erase suspicion. That would just, it's a complete surprise attack, no one is known, and you go, hang on, this is actually very similar to Singapore, just going across. very similar to Singapore, and you're getting the people to read it. And of course, this type of stuff was a great thing in the story was told and retold. You can imagine the Americans having John Wayne do this type of stuff. That remember the Alamo, and you go, the Alamo. There's a lot of occupation history. A lot of double dealing. The Alamo. The Alamo. A lot of these legends come across, and so there's great reference. Everyone knows the 47 samurai, and the fact that they sacrificed themselves. And when you read the actual legend, you say, a lot of these people in Japan are quoting from the legend as they go, it is better to die in battle. Let's go up and take this huge, enormous risk here of being in the Sultan's palace, sort of like, shoot me if you care type of stuff. It's better to die this way. And the idea in that imbued suicide into Japan. And of course then I looked at the click on the suicide rate, the natural suicide rate, if this is such a great cultural thing, and these Japanese troops were just committing suicide. They were suicide troops. They culturally overwhelmed the Europeans. These are suicide troops, and you'll read about it in the next section. What's going on here? But reading the suicide statistics, Japan's got a very high suicide rate, but the suicide rate's not for the number of suicide. I suppose it's dishonor. This is related to not having a job, and that could be males not having a job is a major suicide thing, which is equivalent to this 47 samurais. These samurais were going to be unemployed, so therefore 47 of them suicide to give job. It was an unemployment suicide related thing. So that's interesting. The other interesting statistics is that Switzerland, for all Swiss, is up there with the very large suicide rate. What on earth is going on there? It is also interesting that it's sort of claiming that that Thailand is Japanese. It's sort of claiming that the Vatican is Swiss because they've got Swiss mercenaries there at a time for Swiss mercenaries. Look, it must be part of Switzerland because it's got Swiss soldiers there. And you go, the story might be a little bit more deep than this. But coming back to it, this 47 samurai, you can question, you can say, you don't know nothing. You don't know nothing, mate. You don't know nothing. You're just a nobody. You've just come in out of the science labs, out of teaching, rehab, and all this type of stuff, and just join the queue of all these people who think they know about things. Indeed, I don't think I know about it. I'm just reading it and reading parallel stories, reading the parallel stories of the Germans and the Japanese. And the fact is that whether the Japanese were indoctrinated or not, the idea was that the Japanese, it is true, the Japanese, every single soldier had this simple pamphlet, and the pamphlet was designed to indoctrinate them, and it was designed to reach simple, everyday working Japanese, as they said here in the book. It's designed to be read in simple, clear language in your boat, and it's designed for the average soldier to read. I think the ball's in the court to say, one would therefore have to, given that a action has done and has been successful, and you've got the behavior, you've got the everything lining up, if you want to claim another theory, well, you really have to establish another theory for what's going on. It is very crucially important to see that the story of the Japanese 47 Japanese samurai is the bias, the operating system, which has somehow got rogue in these people and actually authored what they're doing as a theory. It's all theoretical, but it is definitely a code that people know what's going on, and they do talk to each other in this code. Remember such and such a samurai warrior, and the idea of going into battle with your sword, and the idea of a samurai sword, put your sword in your belt, going in like the samurai did, or stuff like that. So there is this belief, and we're going to read from chapter 8 onwards, not this episode, this is going 30 minutes. I'm going to read from chapter 8 on to chapter 13 as we go through this delightful guide of how to invade a country. That is, put floats on your tanks, or your big heavy armour, so it can be pulled ashore, you know, tied up properly. Inflate your bicycles if you want to invade Malaya, and make sure you pump your bicycle tyres up to 10% maximum pressure, because if you do it slightly over, you do it high, you'll get there fast, but your tyres will break. And then again, as you read through it, as you read this, this was slammed together in a couple of months. Look, I think not. You know, just reading this, I think not. These are highly trained and highly trained. There's a whole series of stories which it's put forward, but then you say, hang on, they were discussing in detail the invasion of Malaya from the back with the Germans a year or so before. You know, what on earth is going on? And the Germans were discussing with the Japanese the invasion of Russia. You know, what on earth is going on? Was that true or was it not true? It's hard to know, but there is these photos of the Japanese exchanging their samurai swords with the various high up Germans, both in uniform and picture. So it's worthwhile to see, and it's also quite entertaining to read about this person's telling this beautiful story, and he'll tell it. And so these citations read beautifully at the end, because it's basically a journey through explaining around the Japanese fighting citations for bravery. But there's lots of other bits in the story about saying, I was being shelled by the British naval cannons from Changi Fortress, and it was really dreadful. I thought, you know what, I really want a metal helmet, and my head's not really good. Oh, this Japanese soldier comes up and said, oh, would you like my metal helmet? Oh, no thanks. You know, it's not poorly crafted, but it tells you that the story you're being told is really a container for the belief of this person forward. But nonetheless, there are these gems of this thing, like the pamphlet. You know, this is the pamphlet that he wrote and he issued to the Japanese soldiers. And the big question is, did they believe it? Well, perhaps not, but then you have to have, well, what is the other reason that the entire army behaved in unison like it? It's a very interesting read. Interesting concept. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.